Let me unencode their names for you. NAD27 stands for the North American Datum of 1927. It was the first datum used for mapping or systematic mapping in the United States. It was based on a single reference point in Meade's Ranch in Kansas that was chosen because it was near the middle of the country. GRS 80 was the first truly scientifically and internationally measured ellipsoid based upon measurements from space. So it was the most accurate model that we had of the Earth at the time. GRS stands for Geodetic Reference System of 1980, when it was calculated. And that was the basis, the numbers calculated for it were the basis for many other ellipsoids, including the ones that we use for mapping here in the United States, the North American datum of 1983, NAD83, and the world equivalent that what was then the Defense Mapping Agency chose for the whole world, the World Geodetic System, WGS-84, the system of 1984. Okay. Huge difference between NAD27 and GRS-80 is that the fact that GRS-80 was Earth-centered. Actually, there were earlier Earth-centered ellipsoids, but this was the first one that won sort of international recognition. So the center of the Earth, the geometric center of the Earth, becomes the center of the model. And that's very important if you're going to map the whole planet rather than just one little country. Now, since then, we've gone off in a completely different direction. We now have a global network of continuously operating reference stations from the GPS system, and these allow extremely elaborate computer models to be fit to the size, the actual figure of the Earth. And then these are all averaged, and we agree upon them internationally. And we've now handed the authority for the size and shape of the Earth over to an international body, which has the most wonderful name. It's the International Earth Rotation Service. I love that. Like, they're responsible for anything to do with the Earth and its rotation. And they've decided to have a system based upon the best measurements available now, and it's called the International Terrestrial Reference Frame. So IERS is the International Earth Rotation Service. And the ITRF is continuously improved and updated. We don't use it yet in the United States, although there's been a proposal from the National Geodetic Survey that this be adopted to replace WGS-84. The reason that we use WGS-84 so heavily in the US is that the Department of Defense put an enormous amount of money and research into promoting it while it was developing the global positioning system. So we're stuck with it for at least our lifetimes, probably. Always like this. This is a classic sort of scientific curve. There's Bourgeois's value for the what's called E, the eccentricity of the ellipsoid, as how much it is off from a circle. And you can see that his was not that bad, and then it went a little high, and then eventually we've converged on a value that gets more and more accurate. And the WGS-84, well, actually, that's ITRF 2000 at the end there. So we get closer and closer to actually describing the true shape of the Earth. So as I said, WGS-84 is, it's not the latest and the greatest, but it's pretty darn good. So it's worth looking at its factoids. So when we talk about an ellipse, we talk about the length of this axis, actually that radius, and the length of this radius. Okay, the smaller one we call the semi-minor axis, and the longer one we call the semi-major axis. A and B, or rather B and A, and the ratio B over A is going to be something less than 1, because it's a shorter length over a longer length. So we say take something less than 1 and subtract it from 1, and this gives us what's called F, or the degree of flattening. Think of flattening as how pushed down you are on the actual shape of the Earth. And they are significant differences in the distances. So A for WGS-84 is 6,378,137 meters. And you might say, that's a little bit curious. How did it come out to exactly 1 meter? Well, the answer is obvious. This is before they had computers and everything. They had to work these numbers out by hand with mechanical calculators. So they wanted to set one of the parameters to a whole number to minimize the number of errors involved. So for the other one, we get 6,356,752.3 meters. And actually, the remaining decimal places out of that are still classified top secret, believe it or not. And that gives us a flattening of 1/298.257. 1/298 is good enough for government work. Well, actually it isn't, but you know, good enough for GIS. So this leads us to the next concept of how does an ellipsoid relate to a datum? Well, a datum is the point at which we tie the Earth model to the Earth's surface. Okay? As I've just said, a real changing point was making that point of tying to the surface at the center, the geometric center of the Earth. So then you just need to specify the parameters of the ellipsoid. You also, of course, need to figure out where the zero point is going to be on both axes, but more about that in just a second. So geodetic datums define the size and shape of the Earth and the origin and orientation of the coordinate systems used in mapping. Now, we probably only thought so far really about latitude and longitude, but actually, if you think about it, even latitude and longitude depend on the Earth model. So something like, you know, 0 degrees north, 10 degrees west is very much going to depend upon which ellipsoid we choose. We're going to miss by 100 or more meters if we do that. Now, well, fortunately, in the confused world history of mapping, we have invented hundreds of different datums because, again, every country started with their own datum. When mapping started in the United States in the very early 1800s, the very first point chosen was a completely arbitrary point in Westchester County, New York, that they decided to call Buttermilk for some reason. So there's a point called Buttermilk. The mark is still there, the original location of the origin point for the mapping of the East Coast of the United States. Well, it was very quickly realized that if you use a point in New York to map the United States, the further you get away from it, the more and more inaccurate you get. So it's much better to move your point to the middle of the country, which in fact they did. There's the marker at the top there, which is actually about 20 miles away from the actual point, which is on private land, but you can't go and see it anymore. The marker at Meade's Ranch, the origin point for NAD 27, the dead center for mapping of the United States up until the 1980s. And of course, every time we create another datum, we have to evolve a spherical Earth into an ellipsoidal model, and then we have to check with satellite measurements to make it more precise. Oh, that doesn't look so great. So datums make a big difference. So I'll make the first point, which is that they matter about height. Okay, you've probably heard the term mean sea level. If you look at an old topographic map, it'll say that this building is 110 feet above mean sea level. Well, mean sea level is meaningless. Okay? Back the clock up 10,000 years, the mean sea level was probably 300 meters below where it is today. Fast forward it 50 years, it's probably going to be a meter above where it is today. But the tides go up and down. It's a very, very uneven thing to use for measurement. It's much better if we use an ellipsoid that's based on the whole planet to determine heights. Okay? Now, which ellipsoid we choose, which datum for reference that we use for our elevation, affects heights. So your building that you think was 5 meters above sea level could become 1 meter below sea level just by changing the reference ellipsoid. Okay. Very important thing to note. So you say I could be 5'10". Assuming that that was my reference point, or I could be 10'5". Depends on your datum. So the bottom line here is that whenever you're doing mapping, you open up your metadata file, your projections file, and it doesn't have the datum in there, you're in trouble. At least you're in trouble in the vertical dimension. But you're also in trouble in the horizontal dimension. Because remember, we've got a complex shape ellipsoid. Where we choose to put the center and how we map any given object onto that ellipsoid affects not only its height, but also where it hits the reference model. So our position, our up and down, our left and right, our latitude and longitude is actually going to change again depending upon which ellipsoid we use. So let me just go through this. So while cartography, surveying, navigation, and astronomy all make use of geodetic datums, the science of geodesy is central here. And it's a relatively small discipline. There aren't that many people that practice it. The professional association has only a few hundred members, but they're extremely important because they tell the rest of us all where we are. Different nations and agencies have used different datums as the basis for coordinate systems used in GIS. and for precise positioning systems and for navigation systems. Okay, so in GIS we end up with, I told you it's about data fusion, and over time people have created mapping systems, coordinates, projections, entire mapping programs, navigational systems, etc., all based on different ellipsoids. And now somehow we've got to all mesh them in together. So we might have a navigation system for aircraft that needs to work with one for ships. And it might be based on different parameters. We need to be able to fuse them. So if we reference geodetic coordinates to the wrong datum, we can get positional errors in the order of hundreds of meters. Okay, and when they decided that they were going to recast the United States from NAD 27 to NAD 83, when it finally actually happened and they redrew the Washington DC East quadrangle, somebody noted that the Washington Monument had moved something like 83 meters. And I said, oh my God, it's moved. No, it hasn't moved. We've just changed the reference system. It actually did move when they had the earthquake there a couple of years ago. So another way to express this, imagine here's the surface of the Earth. In the green line, we have the surface of the topography. Okay, and that goes up and it goes down. We go into Death Valley, we're way below sea level. So we're way below the reference ellipsoid. In the red line, we have the geoid. We'll meet that in just a minute. That's a more accurate representation of the actual Earth's size and shape. Then the black line, we have the ellipsoid. Okay, and the ellipsoid may be above or below the surface, depending upon where we are. Okay, so now we've got at least three heights. Actually, there are a lot more than three, but let's simplify it to three at this particular point. But if we go and map those three points, because of the Earth's model, the three points are going to fall in three different locations. That's an extremely important thing to note. I'll see one very practical implication of it in just a second. Okay, so let's go on and start talking about geoids, that last of the Earth models that I'm going to consider. I'm not going to spend much time on it because it'll sort of blow your mind if you think about it too much. An ellipsoid gives the base elevation for mapping called a datum. I've just told you that. Examples, NAD 27, which was an arbitrary datum. It was just fixed at one point in Kansas. NAD 83 is much less arbitrary because it was related to the actual center of the Earth. Now I'll introduce the geoid. It's a figure that adjusts the best ellipsoid and the variation of gravity locally. Okay, so imagine this experiment. If I had a mountain on the topography, and I had a plumb bob hanging on a piece of string, at the top it would point pretty much straight down. You could argue towards the center of the Earth, but who knows where that is. If we took a plumb bob on the surface here and let it hang straight down, it would be attracted towards the mass of the mountain. Yeah, everybody agree that? Comfortable with the gravity and all that stuff? Same thing would happen on this side, it'd be attracted that way. Okay, so the down vector, the force of gravity in its operational sense, varies depending upon where we are with respect to the mass of the Earth underneath us and the topography of its surface. The irony is that mountains are often much less dense than the very concentrated matter at the bottom of the oceans. So the oceans often have some of the densest material under them. Now, I bet you were probably told in high school physics that there's a gravitational constant, right? 9.81 newtons. Hogwash. Gravity depends where you are on the planet. Okay, and so the geoid is a figure that adjusts the ellipsoid. So we're going to start with the reference ellipsoid, and then we're going to adjust it so that gravity is uniform over the entire planet. It's most accurate, it's much more used in geodesy and in orbital geometry than in GIS and cartography, but it's becoming increasingly important because the GPS in your cell phone is becoming sufficiently accurate that it can begin to measure some of these fluctuations and deviations. And then the other cool thing about geoids is that they're dynamic. The 3-meter displacement that followed the huge earthquake in Japan that caused all the damage at Fukushima, that actually displaced two pieces across by 3 meters. That's an enormous amount of displacement. That basically realigns the Earth's gravitational field. So geoids are dynamic in many senses. They also include things like the fact that the Earth doesn't rotate perfectly on its axis. The axis wobbles a little bit, but again, you don't want to know about the Chandler wobble. All right, so what does a geoid look like? Well, here's one that we use in mapping the United States. It's called EGM-96. It's actually not the most recent one. There's one that just came out this year, actually, EGM-12. But this was a particularly good one, measured reasonably well. And I just put it up here just to show you the true complexity when, if you think of the Earth as a static reference frame, the way we pretty much have throughout history. Just take a look at this. Just look at the scale down on the bottom. In blue are areas 105 meters below the best fit reference ellipsoid. 105 meters! Like 320, 330 feet. You can briefly make out sort of continents there. That puts it somewhere out here in the Central Pacific. Indian and African coast. If we look at the opposite extreme, you see the red here is 85 meters. It's 85 meters above the reference ellipsoid. That's quite a significant distance too. And you see that huge proportions of Europe and north of Australia are indeed significant distances above the reference ellipsoid. In some cases, there are individual holes, just little small indentations that we can't explain for any reason. One possible explanation, perhaps the Earth's been hit by a large number of orbiting meteorites over its history, some of which have been large enough to leave big chunks and holes that just get obliterated by all the forces on Earth. We exaggerate it, and this is truly exaggerated. The Earth does not look like that. we've scaled it up a bit for effect. You see that Europe is like a big old bulge there. As we go down off towards India, we go down into a trough. As we come back towards China, we again get up into some high ground. So there's a topography of the geoid as well. All right, so the next topic I want to take up is map scale. And in a way, that's sort of simpler to understand. So I always like to think of it as this way. We start with the Earth, the whole Earth, at 1:1. We change it so that we're going to map the surface of the Earth onto a reference form, the figure of the Earth that we choose. The next thing is to make it smaller. Okay. And that's where map scale comes in. Still going to be three-dimensional, but it's smaller. It's manageable, more manageable. It's projections that are going to flatten it out for us. So scale is based on something in cartography we call the representative fraction. That's the ratio of the distance on the map to the same distance on the ground. So let's say I take a 1 meter rule, put it down on a map, and the map is at 1 to 10,000, let's say. That same distance would be 10,000 meters on the ground. Just a straightforward multiplier. Most maps that we deal with in GIS fall between about 1 to 1,000,000 and about 1 to 1,000. Okay? Actually, nautical charts, we sometimes, and atlases, we go up a little bit further to like about 1 to 8,000,000. What does that mean? Well, think about it. Well, I'll give you some examples in a second. At 1 to 1,000,000, the entire Earth would fit onto something that wouldn't quite fit in this auditorium, be a little bit bigger. There actually is a globe at exactly 1 to 1,000,000 in Freeport, Maine. It's called Eartha. You can look it up on Google. It's pretty cool. They made a 1 to 1,000,000 globe that freely rotates, and you can see it from the highway. It's in a big glass-fronted building. And it's pretty substantial. It's big. 1 to 1,000, well, 1 meter on the map would be 1 meter on the ground would be 1 millimeter on the map. So I'd be able to quite clearly see the width of 10 hairs would be like going from here to here. That's a pretty large scale map. It's a very detailed map. We can show, say, the whole, all of this room and where all of you are sitting on it quite easily. We go beyond 1 to 1,000, we're really dealing with engineering plans and construction blueprints and not really maps. We go beyond 1 to 1,000,000, we very quickly get to scales where the whole world's being shown in a very short space, and eventually, you know, the Earth is like a little gobstopper or something. It's not really usable for navigation. Now, I started with a statement, I'll say it again. It's often said that GIS is scaleless because we can zoom in and out as much as we like. If we want to choose a scale that doesn't make any sense, you know, 1:83,321, we can do that. We can resize our window to make it according to that. When we're zoomed at any particular level, we don't really care what the scale is. Now, that's indeed true, but the point that I always like to make is that we can never get rid of the fact that the data from which GIS maps are produced all had a scale when they were first made. Or they had a relevant scale because of the system of measurement that was being used to collect the data, perhaps GPS, or perhaps digitized from an existing map. So I always say that that scale, the origin scale, is sort of burned onto the data. It's almost impossible to remove its effects. It's always going to be there to some degree. An example in just a minute. So here's my take home here. To compare or edge match maps in a GIS, both maps have to be in the same scale. And they have to have a common extent. Okay, what does that mean? Well, if I'm going to put two maps together and I hope them to match, they'd better both be at the same scale, 1:24,000, 1:100,000, whatever. And then secondly, they'd better have a common extent. So I don't particularly want to pull up a map inside a GIS that just has Great Britain over here and New Zealand over there, nothing else. They don't have a common extent. I want data that overlays the area that I'm interested in. And then my personal little piece at the bottom there. The US went officially metric in the 1980s. Okay. Up until about 1982, there was an Office of Metrification in the United States that was slowly working towards this country becoming compatible with the rest of the world. There are only two countries left in the world that are not on the metric system. Libya and the United States. Do I need to go on? Okay, why is scale important? It's this. Often, I have to do this inside a GIS. On the left-hand side is some material that I captured. Let's say it's a river that I digitized from a map at 1:24,000, where I had every little nook and cranny of the stream. On the right-hand side, I only had the 1:250,000 quad, and obviously, that is going to be much more generalized. I can blow them up and display them at the same scale, but I can't get rid of the fact that they came from maps at different scales. So they're showing different levels of detail. In an ideal world, I would collect everything at the most detailed level scale imaginable, and then throw away information to work at any particular scale. But we don't live in an ideal world. Now, worse than joining side to side, usually we're putting those maps one on top of each other. Okay, so let's say that same river boundary is the border between Missouri and Kentucky. And it comes from a generalized map. It's not going to show the New Madrid Loop. A more detailed map will show the New Madrid Loop. I'm not going to tell you what the New Madrid Loop is. I want you to look it up. All right, a little bit about scale and accuracy. I thought it might be fun to zoom in with Google Earth, so I did so. And if you can't quite see it, it's down here in the bottom of the image, right here. It says that it can tell me quite definitively that my cursor is at 34 degrees, 0.412187 north. Okay, well, let's just think about that for a second. I just gave you a fact that 1 degree, at least the equator, is at 111,111 meters. So if I'm resolving latitude and longitude to 6 decimal places, what I'm actually implying is that I can resolve places on a map to within 11 centimeters on the surface of the Earth. Hogwash. Okay. Nobody can map to 11 centimeters, even a surveyor. Shh, don't say that. Oops, it's on the tape. All right. So de facto, we need to be realistic about the levels of accuracy and the precision with which we can make statements on maps. Most reasonable applications, we're quite happy to have it within a meter. And that simplifies matters a lot, as we'll see when we deal with coordinates in the next lecture. All right, this being the start of the end of the regular season and the Yankees qualifying yet again for the World Series, or at least the playoffs, always brings me back to the theme of baseball. So let's say we had a baseball. Oh, I forgot to bring mine in. Well, I've got an Earth about the size of a baseball. I'll use that. It's actually a Christmas tree ornament, but I really like it quite a bit. It's about the size of a baseball. So let's say I measured, well actually I didn't measure this, but I measured a baseball. It was 226 millimeters around. Okay, and I know that it's, if I go from the same distance all the way around the Earth, it's 40 million meters approximately. So I just do the division, and this gives a representative fraction for this globe at 1 to 177 million. Okay. Now, I don't know about you, this might be useful on a transatlantic flight or something like that, but it's not really that useful as far as information display or visualization is concerned. So this is a bit coarse. When we begin to get more detailed, we meet this system. These are called geographic coordinates. We know them as latitude and longitude, and I hope you learned about them in about fourth grade, but you probably haven't met them since, funnily enough, geography being the state that it is. So let's take a look at latitude and longitude. We have a nice natural origin point for latitude at the equator. Now you can actually measure when you're on the equator by measuring the length of day and night or by measuring the altitude of certain stars. So you can actually determine by direct observation whether or not you're on the equator. We'll call that zero. And we'll go up to 90 degrees, which is the North Pole. And we'll go down to 90 degrees, which is the South Pole. Actually, there are about 20 different ways of writing latitudes and longitudes, but it was decided a long time ago that we would make north positive and south negative. Okay, so if I say negative 90, I mean the South Pole. Lines which have equal latitude are called parallels. And we say that because they're parallel to each other on the globe. Lines going the other way are called meridians, and the easiest one to imagine is the one that is called the prime meridian, but more about that is not so easy to imagine, as we'll see in just a second. The problem with meridians is that they need an arbitrary origin point. There is no natural origin point like the poles and the equator for longitude. In fact, this was often called the problem of the longitude. And again, it was one of the world's greatest and most challenging scientific problems for a very long time. In the system that we use, geographic coordinates, we assume that we have a point of origin, the prime meridian, as it's called, and that its value is zero. And then we number off 180 degrees east, making up positive longitude, and we measure off 180 degrees west, measuring off negative longitude. So when you think about it, in the United States, the East Coast is going to have like negative something, let's say 70, and in the West Coast we're going to have negative something, let's say 120. Those are the kinds of orders of magnitude that we're going to be dealing with. Now one other point to note is that we have 90 degrees of south of latitude in the southern hemisphere, we've got 90 in the northern hemisphere, it's 180 degrees of latitude. And then we've got 360, it's 180 plus 180 degrees of longitude. So the Earth is twice as wide as it is high, right? Oh, it isn't. It's three-dimensional. Okay. But you get the idea as far as measuring distance is concerned. Okay, so this is what we mean by latitude and longitude. How do we deal with that point of the arbitrary origin? Well, how it was originally dealt with in the United States was to declare a particular point to be the American meridian. And man, this point moved around. There are at least four places where the American meridian was located over the history of mapping the United States. And I've just had to research them for another purpose. So originally it was the center of the White House. That's why the whole thing's built symmetrical, going up from the ellipse up through the White House. And there was a marker on that up in about 20th Street or somewhere in Northwest. But I've looked at that marker, it's no longer there. Apparently it was bulldozed. I mean, bulldozed a long time ago, several hundred years ago. Then they decided that it was much better to use an observatory to take astronomical measurements and choose that as the meridian. So they moved it to the original Naval Observatory, which was then replaced by the the old Naval Observatory, which is up behind George Washington University, if you've ever been up there. And I went up there one afternoon trying to find the original point, and I thought I might actually be able to get into the grounds of the old observatory, but I was very quickly turned away by very gruff-looking soldiers with fixed bayonets and told to buzz off. But apparently there's only a marker showing where it used to be, that it's no longer there. But fortunately, George Washington University put this lovely marker and actually a line across the road on 24th and H Street in Washington, D.C., if you want to go there yourself, and marked it as the American Meridian. Why is this relevant? Well, this was the zero reference point for maps of the United States up until the International Meridian Conference, 1884. So if you go and find a very old map of the United States, its latitude and longitudes, its latitudes are going to look good, but its longitudes are going to look really weird. And I have an atlas at home, an American atlas of Great Britain from this period that actually has both Greenwich and the Washington meridians shown on the same map, top and bottom. Now, why am I mentioning this? Well, it was critical because it turns out to be almost totally compatible with Greenwich. It's only 3 minutes off, just a little tiny amount. But, of course, this was where all the western states' boundaries were measured from in whole numbers of degrees. The goal, original Jefferson's ideal for partitioning the United States, is that states would be 4 degrees of latitude by 7 degrees of longitude. Not many of them ended up with those dimensions, but that was the goal. So maybe Colorado got the closest. But they're all measured from this origin point. But of course, that didn't last long. It lasted until the age of steam. In the age of steam, it was very quickly noticed that if you could go from one end of the continent to the other in a matter of hours rather than weeks, and this was also noticed in Europe, that if you were going to have a schedule for the trains, it was absolutely essential to adopt some kind of standard time that everybody could treat as the same method for time. If everybody used solar time, you'd be in big trouble. Okay? Everybody's time would be different. Now, in China, they've never really gone off of solar time. So the whole nation of China, which is the equivalent of about, 8 or 9 time zones wide, is all in one time zone, Beijing's time zone. Okay. So that was done away with, and this standard was adopted in 1884. China wasn't there to sign it. But a Congress happened. It was actually at the old State Department building. I haven't been able to establish exactly where the meeting took place, but there were a number of countries represented, and they voted on where they were going to have prime meridian and what was going to be the standard unit of measure for the world. They chose the meter, by the way. And what was going to be the standard day. Okay. As far as longitude is concerned, it is the opinion of this Congress that it is desirable to adopt a single prime meridian for all nations in place of the multiplicity of initial meridians which now exist. And there were dozens of them. They were all over the place, including the Washington meridian. That the conference proposes to the governments here represented the adoption of the meridian passing through the center of the transit instrument at the observatory as Greenwich as the initial meridian for longitude. I'll explain exactly what that means in just a second. And that this meridian longitude should be counted in two directions up to 180 degrees, east longitude being plus and west longitude minus. See, I don't lie. I just tell you what the facts are. Here I am standing on the prime meridian about a year ago. This is the part that's, I'm in a suit because I've just given a keynote speech. Otherwise I wouldn't be. But that line that's actually painted on the outside and has been repainted nicely in black and white is the original line marker going through Greenwich. On the right-hand side there is a picture of the transit instrument. Okay, so this was a huge transit. It's basically an enormous telescope on a great big pivot that can look up at the sky at any angle. A transit means that you sit there with a pendulum clock waiting for a particular star to come into your view. It goes through this marker on the lens, goes through this marker on the lens, you time the first and the second, you take the average of the times, and that's the time of transit of whatever star or planet happens to be. You write those times down for hundreds of years, and you have a pretty darn good record of not only what's out there in the outer sky, but also exactly where you are on the Earth looking out at that sky. So that's the transit instrument. You'll notice that it's all covered in plexiglass now, but you can basically see that there are these huge cranks on the wall that open these windows going up the top. And I had to get an older picture, so there's me still with hair. Standing on the outside of what you were just looking at the inside of, and this entire building has hinged doors that open up all the way across right up to the top of the roof. So you can look at any point in the sky, but only on this little narrow slit where you're going to measure the transit. And in Britain, you have to take out about half the nights anyway because they're cloudy or raining. And there's the meridian line passing through it. So literally, when they said the center of the transit instrument and the observatory at Greenwich, they meant this line, exactly that line. That was going to be the line. Here's another take-home lesson for today. I told you a little bit earlier that when you change the datum, you change the location. And in fact, if you go there today, which I also did at the same time, and put a GPS receiver out and measure your longitude, it's not zero when you're standing on the prime meridian, the Greenwich meridian. It's about 104 meters off. The true meridian for WGS 84 is about 104 meters east of the meridian. Now, this was a huge deal back in 2000 when they built this massive Millennium Dome down on the river just below it. You may have actually seen this site because it was where all the equestrian events for the Olympic Games this year were held. It was, in fact, on the grass right there down below the observatory. They covered the whole thing in metal and sand for the event. Okay, so here's this is off of OpenStreetMap. You see that there's the meridian marked, and there's the Greenwich Observatory, and there's a difference between the two. Why? Because you changed the datum, you changed the location. You changed the model of the Earth and re-snap it to the Earth, you've moved things. And in this case, you've moved them 104 meters east. That's quite a significant difference if you're trying to match two maps up together with each other. Don't believe me? Here it is. You see east at the bottom there? It says east 000 degrees, 00 minutes, 00.0 seconds. And on the left-hand side was when I was actually